it is, in my view, not shocking that we see these wars of choice. They've been true all through my career. The brazenness of this is something different, as you note. There's not even an attempt at an excuse. There's not even an attempt at any kind of process. The American people are completely against this. Why is this? Two reasons. One, we have slid into imperial behavior over decades. And so all of the real institutions of control were long ago pushed aside. But second is the particular personality of Donald Trump, a dark triad personality of megalomania, malignant narcissism, and psychopathy. This is something different. You should not have a person like this as president. This is especially of such a powerful country. This is extremely dangerous. So we have this mix, but the underlying reasons is the erosion of the most basic constitutional checks. After all, I have to point out from a juridical point of view, the UN Charter is not only something that the U.S. subscribes to, it is the law of the land. It is a treaty duly ratified by the United States Senate in July 1945, which under our Constitution makes it the law of the land. But we hear little of the Constitution. The Supreme Court, thank God, rallied a few weeks ago and said Trump can't set the whole trade regime. That's unconstitutional. That was a glimmer of light. But when it comes to foreign policy, sadly, those same nine justices would like, I don't want to put words in their mouth, God forbid, but would likely side with the imperial presidency. Why does Europe have not a word about this? Well, this is what we've been asking for years. How did Europe become a complete vassal of the United States, which it is? It is a little hard to understand. Partly it's the selection of the leaders, which have to go through the U.S. approval mill, or they get pushed aside easily. Partly it is simple mechanics. If you have U.S. military bases on your soil, you are an occupied country, whether you like it or not. You have the CIA there, you have subversion, you have U.S. direct political interference. You are a semi-occupied country. But I have to just tell you how shocking it is to hear this. I was at the U.N. Security Council last week. I had been invited to testify about the war, and then the UK and the US blocked me from testifying. This is par for the course. That's the least of it. But as I listened, of all people, the Danish ambassador launched into a tirade against Iran on the day that the US and Israel attacked Iran. She couldn't mention that Iran had been bombed or that 150 schoolgirls had been murdered or that this was a violation of the UN Charter, an unprovoked attack by Israel and the United States. She didn't even mention that. She just went into a tirade against Iran. This is the one that someday will turn to the UN and say, how can you not help us with Greenland after the United States has invaded her country? I went up to her afterwards to have a word. I wanted to point out that this is not safe for Denmark. She looked up from her notes, looked at me, turned around and walked away. I called after her, could I have a word with you? Walked away. And so this is the state of affairs in our world today. Europe is useless. We know it. We bemoan it every day. Useless. Not a voice of sanity, except for Pedro Sanchez. Let's champion him because he's been very brave. And President Connolly of Ireland, who knows about this. But for the rest of Europe, nothing right now on this point. And so the US and Europe don't uphold the learnings of World War II or the law of the international community in the UN Charter. We've lost the reflexes for that. And sorry to ramble on, but in 2003, many European countries, and I remember walking across the green with Dominique de Villepin, who had just spoken at the UN Security Council, France objected to the US-Iraq war. Wonderful. We don't hear a voice like that in a major European country now.
No, we don't. Let's talk about Iran, because my own clear sense is that there's been very little understanding of that country. There were a lot of assumptions that this war was going to end very quickly. There's been a universal belief among Western leaders that the government is not only unpopular, but illegitimate in some way, never exactly explained, that the course of the war has come as a terrible surprise, that nobody expected that it would have dragged on in the way that it has. And you are starting to see in the media, certainly here in Britain, what you might call the worm of doubt. People are asking, is this going to go on for a long time? Is this going to turn out well? What if it doesn't? What if we've underestimated Iran? What if we've underestimated the strength of its institutions and its armed forces and its level of economic and social cohesion? Well, if they have underestimated all of those things, that really does argue again about their planning, their quality of planning being completely wrong, because as you say, they've been thinking about doing this for years, for decades. They should have a very clear understanding of Iran, and it seems that they don't. I mean, is that also your perception? I mean, it's certainly mine, that they really don't understand Iran, perhaps because they've fallen in with these grotesque ideas of domination of the Middle East, domination of hegemony, domination of all sorts of things. And one of the things I've learned in my life is that people who lose touch with reality on one thing eventually lose touch with reality on everything. Is that what the problem is?
I have a general principle which I've tried to get instated for many, many years, which is that the United States should not be allowed to bomb any country unless more than half the U.S. population can name two cities in that country. This would end all American wars. Americans know nothing about Iran. And that includes our leadership. Of course, I'm being jocular. We should not be bombing other countries, period. But the ignorance is beyond imagining. Donald Trump, of course, knows zero about everything. Everything. The man is a complete, total ignoramus. And that is not my testimony. That is what I hear from leaders around the world that deal with him. He's simple-minded, and this is also extraordinarily concerning. No, they don't have a plan. They don't have a strategy. They are relying basically on an old CIA failed ploy, which is get the U.S. into something and then escalate as needed. So that's not a military strategy. If it could take us back again 64 years to another CIA concoction, which was the invasion of Cuba, the Bay of Pigs in April 1961. They had no plan, but Alan Dulles thought once we get people on the ground and if they get under attack, Kennedy will have to call in air cover and we will be in a full-fledged invasion of Cuba. Now the plan is will escalate as needed. That's why Trump talks about now openly, well, we're going to have to put soldiers in. We're going to have to put the boots on the ground, as it's called. I don't think this is going to happen, by the way, because the United States public is so much against this, at least 3-1 against it. And it's going to go to much longer, stronger opposition very, very soon as people see how completely reckless, violent, boneheaded all of this is. But the answer to the question is they do not have a plan. Netanyahu's plan is get the U.S. involved. Those who favor this have the plan that once we're involved, we'll just escalate as necessary. The whole thing is a complete concoction and debacle. And the best evidence of that is the market judgment, because that's a kind of summary of those who are whose money is directly at stake. Today, oil prices have soared well above $100 a barrel by some quotes that I saw just in the few minutes before we started, up to about $120 a barrel. Oil is on the route to doubling in price over this very early stretch from the pre-war price until today. It's not quite there yet, but it's headed there. This is an economic calamity, but the point is that those who put their money down in bets and the market bet on energy is the cleanest and clearest of this bets is that we have a disaster unfolding.
Let's talk about that, because you're perhaps the best person to discuss this. $120 a barrel oil, we have already a very difficult economic situation in Europe altogether. In Germany, they've been talking about deindustrialization. In Britain, there's a strong sense of economic malaise. In every Western country, people's living standards are under very, very great stress. $120 a barrel oil, what is that going to do to the world economy now, especially if the shock continues very long? And did the people who made the proximate decisions to start this now, did they not realize that this might happen? I mean, it was so likely that it would happen. How could they miss it? But tell us, first of all, about what are the possible outcomes. And by the way, before you do, can I just point to people what a prescient economic commentator you are in some respects? I remember when Trump brought in the tariffs, you said that the tariffs would not reduce the American trade deficit. They didn't, just to say. So given that kind of exemplary track record, what are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, if I could just say on the tariffs very briefly, I said, A, they're illegal, brazenly illegal. B, they wouldn't reduce the trade deficit. Three, they wouldn't create manufacturing jobs, which on our February report are down 100,000 jobs from last year to this year. The whole thing is so incredibly imbecilic. Okay, I'll put that aside. Yeah. On this one, you know, this is weird, but my PhD dissertation 46 years ago was on oil shocks. It was doing the first modeling of the oil shocks of 1973-74 and 1979-80. I wrote the first book about the economics of worldwide stagflation, published in 1982. So I've been thinking about this for decades, actually. The fact of the matter is this is an extremely, extremely serious shock to the world economy. It is likely to be prolonged. Of course, we're in the very first days, so things can change. But it doesn't seem like the U.S. is backing down, and it does seem like the energy facilities of the Gulf region and Iran are being destroyed or heavily damaged. And one country after another is shutting in its production because you can't produce if you can't store or ship. And they can do neither right now. So we're seeing soaring oil prices. We're seeing another important indicator, the volatility of the stock market soar once again. That's called the VIX index. That is also a predictor of a serious economic crisis. So I believe we're entering into a worldwide economic crisis this year. When it happened in the 1970s, output relative to trend, in other words, taking into account that world output has an underlying upward trend, and then comparing where things were a year after the oil shock from where they were would have been expected to be, the downturns in both 73, 74, and 79, 80 were on the order of 4 or 5% of world output relative to trend. Very sizable shocks. A lot of economic pain, a lot of unemployment. I think we're heading for that right now. Of course, things can change. These are early days, but at least as of the past few days, those who really are watching in minute detail what's being blown up, what production is stopping, what the chances of the U.S. military opening the Strait of Hormuz and so forth, what they're telling us is this is a very, very serious economic crisis lying ahead. And I think that it comes in the context of a lot of weakness in the U.S. already. The jobs declined in February. They've basically been stagnant or in decline for several months. Europe is in persistent crisis in a very weak state across Europe. So I would expect that this would mean a downturn in both the United States and Europe this year. Trump being insane, actually. Oh, so oil prices will go up. So it's the price we have to bear. The voters will have a different idea very soon. This will be true across Europe. There is revulsion at the political class in Europe. There is revulsion of Trump. And we need to remember, these are the people we see strutting on the stage. They are not liked. They are not popular. They are not following public opinion whatsoever. And occasionally, rarely, but occasionally, the public gets a say in this, and the say is not going to be a happy one. Of course, all of this depends on U.S. ballots actually being counted in November, which is going to be another drama coming up.
Mm-hmm. We're just having an election, by the way, in Baden-Württemberg in Germany. And the early reports are that the CDU has lost ground significantly and might lose the state. So anyway, we'll see. Is there any way back? Is there any way out of this mess? I mean, I have to say that the idea of sending in the U.S. Navy to provide escorts to tankers. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a delusion on a delusion on a delusion. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so that's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. So, I mean, what can be done? Because the other great change in the world is that the United States does not have the overwhelming monopoly over power that it did, say, 30 years ago. There are other very, very big players now. There's China, where Donald Trump is supposed to go at the end of this month. There's Russia, of course. There's India, too. There's all sorts of countries. One gets the sense that none of them are happy. What might happen? Might we actually see an international movement to end this war outside the West. That would be something very new if it were to be effective.
Yes, there will be a world rising demand to end the war as the economic pain hits. And that economic pain is going to hit quite quickly in prices, of course, for petrol and diesel and in electricity costs and in other ways. So it won't take that long for the pain to be widely felt. This is one point. That will cause politicians to scramble. What do we do? How do we survive? What do we say to our publics? The way that this war ends, and the only way, in my view, that it ends, is that the United States and Israel stop their war of aggression, period. I don't think it's going to end at the negotiating table. I don't see what the negotiations would be about. I don't see there being a possibility of negotiating right now. But there is absolutely the possibility that Israel and the United States stop the attack. Of course, that is a loss of face. Who gives and I won't say it, but basically, who could care that Trump and Netanyahu lose face? Despicable people who went against the world good. Of course they should lose face. They're disgraceful. We need the fighting to stop. It could stop if there is a crescendo of voices for it to stop. That crescendo will not start in Europe because they don't even have a voice that they know how to utilize right now. But that even that will come later. The voices have to start with where you absolutely indicated, and that is with the BRICS countries. China and Russia, of course, are allies of Iran. They're supporting Iran. The idea that, oh, they're giving intelligence, are you kidding? Why not? This is also a U.S. war directed against Russia and China, have no doubt about it. This is world hegemony at stake. Of course, they are going to give material support, financial support, military support, probably not direct troops, but a lot of other kinds of support. Of course, that's going to happen. But diplomatically, what I find most interesting is India. India, to my mind, is actually the decisive factor in this right now. Sad to say, India plays two roles, one of them completely erroneous for India, and the other very important. The erroneous role is India thinking that it will replace China as America's supplier, and that it will reap benefits as together with the United States and Israel against, well, with the United States against China and Israel as a provider of military technology and intelligence technology. So India has sidled up to the United States despite all the abuses. And it hasn't really ended that. Modi was in Israel a few days ago. For God's sake, what the heck is that? And there's also, well, there's other considerations, but that's one side. The other side is India should remember that its colonization by the British Empire wasn't a great party. It was a disaster. And the same with the United States, to become a vassal of the United States, to play with the United States in the Quad, to suffer a calamitous energy crisis because India is completely energy import dependent from the Middle East because of a U.S.-Israeli war of imperialism is not what India wants. So India has the presidency of the BRICS this year. If India, Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa, the African Union, Egypt, Ethiopia, all stand up and say, this is outrageous. And if Europe, God help us, would follow Pedro Sanchez and say, this is not good for us. Actually, the fighting will stop. After that, I think the consequences will be extremely significant. Of course, the U.S. will have been exposed, as exactly Kissinger's adage has it, to be a friend of the United States is fatal. This will be proved yet again. I don't think Israel can continue in this mad, violent way after this. It will have created a worldwide crisis, not just a regional crisis. I think Israel, if it continues in this way, should be expelled or suspended from the UN, as South Africa was. It is a violent, vicious state that either regains its senses or is going to lose its hold. So this is going to be another reckoning that will come. But I think the way this war will end is the world telling the United States and Israel, stop, it's over, you're wrecking the whole world.